Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
How's it going?
Oh. I feel like when I look back at some point and they're like, when was your breaking point during the pandemic? I was like 7 months in. I think 7 months in is where I just
this
totally
week?
Lost it. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why this week. Just, you know, it was my time, I guess.
Yeah, it comes for us all eventually.
So it does.
iPhone event week. It feels real weird to me for a bunch of reasons. Obviously, not having an event to go to is strange. The 1 hour length, where it literally feels like they just sawed off an hour and dropped it into September. In a normal year, I have a hard time believing the September announcements wouldn't have just all happened and the October announcements in 1 2-hour event.
Well, I mean, we discussed last week the whole thing with the iPad Air, which is now shipping, but, you know,
Available for order, not shipping.
Sorry, pre-ordered.
Yes.
I'm sorry, that's right. But my point being...
Simultaneous with the iPhone, which means why did you announce it a month early?
Why did you announce it a month
other
early?
Other than to give it a clear stage to be announced. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, but it was kind of random.
Yeah. And I've found it's weird because, you know, there are days that Apple does something and then I spend like the whole rest of the day writing and then the whole like next day writing and all that. And with this, I wrote a piece for Macworld and I wrote a little short piece about the weird pricing, which has been which there's an update about, by the way, that as of today, T-Mobile and Sprint seem to have the same $30 off thing. So basically, it's just if you're in an alternative wireless company, or you're ordering the SIM-free phone, essentially, that you have to pay $30 extra, which I still don't like, but there we are. So you know, anyway, what I was saying is that I've not written a lot about it, and part of that is because I'm thinking, and part of it is that I don't know if I have a lot to say right now because there are lots of phones and they're shipping in waves and we're going to get the phones and we're going to see them. And I kind of, a lot of my thought is just like, well, let's see how it is. Let's see. I mean, I'm sure the first wave of reviewers already have them and are under embargo for probably next week sometime. Right. But, and I'm not in that group, but I just have this, like, I'm not quite sure what to write about them.
I feel
them.
Like there's less speculation about this is an increasing factor in phone updates, is that the product is far more mature than it was, you know, 5 years ago even. And it's not to say there's not interesting features and capabilities being added, but increasingly those features and capabilities are things that I feel like you want to have your hands on before you start writing or talking about. I mean, there's only so far speculation can take you, and especially when there's like a week lag time between, you know, the phones being announced and the phones being shipping, which has been pretty standard for a while now. It's like, well, do we spend, you know, do we spend 1,000 words fulminating on something that will be answered in a week, or will take even longer once you've got it because you want to say like, well, all right, there's this new camera feature, but I need to really spend some time putting it through its paces. I think we talked a little bit about some of the stuff that's strategic. You know, I think 5G is a great example of that, of something like, why is this here? Why did they announce it now?
Right? Oh,
it's
yeah.
more about Apple's business choices than it is about the phone itself, because ultimately, it's not going to matter for the phone in the near future.
I got to say, we are in a weird position where the iPhone is Apple's most important product, but at this particular moment in time, least
kind of most
interesting.
Boring.
Yep. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, it just
weird.
Is.
It's weird how that happened, but I agree with you. So my Macworld column, which comes out on Monday, I talked about the HomePod Mini the whole time because, you know, I think there's more interesting stuff to say about that in the sense that Apple is still trying to figure out what to do with that product line.
Right.
And that means they make choices. And the choices are sometimes good and sometimes bad, or sometimes just baffling. Why did they do this? Or why didn't they do that? And with the iPhone, especially because everything leaked ahead of time, and especially because rumors have been going for so long, it felt like there were even fewer things than usual that were like, yep, knew that.
Well,
yep, knew
and the,
that.
The thing I wrote about was the size variation, because that's always struck me in all the rumors as being the most interesting thing they're doing, is releasing four phones and having that small phone again, which is by far the smallest flagship phone that they've offered since the iPhone 5, right?
Yes, exactly.
Or 5S. Was there a 5S? Yeah. So yeah. That. The one before the 6. Like, when they introduced the 6, they went up in size, and we haven't had a flagship phone that it has been smaller than that until now. Mm-hmm. And and that's why my Macworld column was about that, although somebody was telling me, like, there are lots of other angles there on Twitter, and I misunderstood him at first, and I was like, oh, no, you're right. And I explained my process of writing a Macworld column. I don't know if this is similar to you, but, like, I'm trying to do one idea for 800 words. Mm-hmm. Tangents are not going to go in the Macworld column,
yes,
because they don't pay me for the tangents, and I'm going to file a column with an idea. And so my focus there was, if you're used to the 10 or size, or maybe uncomfortable with it, but you've gone with it. Now the Mini's there, and it's like, what do I do now? Because the 12 Pro and the 12, actually, and this is an angle that I didn't pursue, like, they're slightly larger than the 10, but not a lot. And it's mostly just in height, and it's like a tenth of an inch. So it's almost exactly the same size. But the Mini exists now. And, like, for me, that's the most important or most interesting thing, is that you have size options.
Yeah.
Secondarily, and the thing that I didn't write about, which I'm going to have to write about at some point, but which I also think is fascinating, is, you know, the knock on the iPhone 11, and for me, and the XR was in this too, is it was cheaper, but it was also big.
Yep.
But not like big, like the Pro Max, but big. And, in all the avalanche of things, I didn't really notice. I mean, I knew it in general, but I didn't notice the particulars of the specs until I looked. The 12 and the 12 Pro are the same size.
They're exactly the same chassis, basically.
So the 12 is smaller, noticeably smaller than the 11 was.
Right.
So no
the
longer...
The 12 Pro is a hair larger than the 11 Pro.
Yeah, but basically the 11... was like the XR, a kind of larger, cheaper phone, and that's kind of gone by the wayside. The 12 is basically the size of the 12 Pro. And the merchandising is kind of the most interesting thing about the iPhone. It's like, it's our most important product. You can buy it in all these different shapes. Like, try them out.
Yeah, I think this is, well, it's smart, right? Because as we just discussed, you know, if things are getting a little less interesting and a little more staid because the pace of innovation is leveling off a bit,
mm-hmm,
one option is to broaden your choices for,
like,
consumers.
And it's what we said about the Apple Watch, right? Which is adding colors is nice and provides some variety and some motivation to buy and some excitement that's easy to do from a production standpoint, but brings something to the party that you might not have prioritized if you had a whole bunch of other things to do. But in a quieter update period, you want to give it some juice. And so you put in new colors and new finishes and things like that. And that kind of helps it out. The truth is that, you know, we do a lot of tracking of year to year, but, you know, most people are buying their phone, you know, 2, 3, 4 years down the road. Yep. And so for them, it's a big leap, but we have to look at it in terms of, like, how are they adjusting their product line? And, you know, I think it's directly what I said before. It's directly related to those two things, which is that it's the most important product and the least interesting product, right? It is. That's why it is the way it is now, is because they need to do things to make it an appealing product, because it is an appealing product. And it's not like it's bad. Like, it's faster and it's better cameras and it's all those things. It's just on this sort of progression over time. So you do stuff, you know, well, what can you do? And the answer is, you can give people different options so that you can sort of spread it out a little bit and make every one of your potential buyers happier by giving them a phone that fits them better. That's that's nice. I think the Mini is going to be a hit. I really do.
I agree.
I think there's a whole subgroup of people who've been kind of, like, lukewarm on using Apple's phones because they've been so big. And although big phones sell, they don't sell to 100% of the market. And I would say also the Android market doesn't like small phones either. So this is an interesting place for Apple
advantage.
To say, I got it. You know, boom, right here, we're doing this.
I was curious, and I just looked at what the rest of the lineup is right now, and I was intrigued to see so the SE obviously still there, just revved, the 11 from last year, which makes sense, you know, to keep that around as sort of a lower cost model. The 10R is still there. Still there.
That's 10R still
weird,
kicking.
Weird choice, but it means everything except the SE is the new style now.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. It strikes me as funny that both the 10R and the 11 are there, because the 11 feels like it's the 10R, but even newer. But I guess that's the old
10RS.
Keep the 6 and the 7 around or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. And maybe, who knows, maybe there's just an inventory thing and then it'll drop off in 4 months or something. It'll just disappear. But it does give them a price range to choose from and you know, to do some upsell and all that. I don't know.
Did you pre-order a phone this morning?
I did not. Okay. And this is something I've talked about, I think, on Upgrade before, and I think maybe even here, but it's I have the colossal privilege of being a product reviewer. Mm-hmm. And so I end up not buying phones generally when they come out. Also, it's my off year. So if I were to buy one, I'd probably have to return one, you know, and do a trade-in. And I'm not sure, as we just said, like, I'm not sure what I want, if I want anything. And because I'm a product reviewer, I had the luxury that over the course of the next month, I will be presumably getting my hands on, for an extended amount of time, all four models. And I can figure out what I like and don't like. So for me, it's a huge luxury. But if I were not in that position, I would have given some serious thought to trading in one of our iPhone, either the 11 Pro or the 10 that Lauren is using, and getting the Mini. But I'm not entirely sure that I'm not going to pick up the Mini and be like, oh no, this is too small, right? That may happen. I may have been ruined by the iPhone X class. But anyway, I didn't get up early at the ungodly hour that Apple makes West Coast people get up now. Oh, woe is us, woe is us. What did you do?
I did pre-order a phone because I'm on the Upgrade program.
And right.
With the Upgrade program, it's always like, you know what? Why not? it's a weird position to be in. And again, you know, it means you're basically renting a phone for all year and you're paying your monthly payments, etc. But for me, it makes sense. It's a budget thing that I've now been able to, like, kind of easily allocate for the last several years, because since the iPhone X, it's been basically a constant amount. I will note, my payment went down this year for two reasons. One, the comparable iPhone 12 Pro is actually just a smidgen cheaper than previous years, at least when I looked at the comparable monthly costs. Not much, a buck, maybe something like that. But I also dropped a size, because when I got into the whole, like, you know, the new phones and something like that, Apple for a long time had like 64 and 256 options. And I was always like, you know, 64 is too small. I just do not I have too much stuff for a 64 gig phone. I don't need 256 gigabytes, but that's the only option. And of course, this year, the base model is a 128.
Right.
And I was like, looked at my phone storage, said, oh, it's about 100 gigs. Hmm. And if I enable the old, which I had never done before, but I was going through looking at apps, I'm like, yeah, I feel like I'm okay enabling the offload apps that aren't used very often, where it saves all the data and you just re-download it if you need it. I was like, great, I'll do that. Drop me to like 60 gigs. I was like, you know what? 128, it's going to last me at least a year. That's fine.
Yeah.
And I will revisit it next year. But, you know, saves me, I think, something like $80 or $90 on the year, basically, because it drops the payment by $6 or $7 a month.
So 12 Pro, 128.
Yep.
And color?
I was pretty sure I was going to pick blue, and I did. I was a space gray / black / graphite, I guess now, phone user for many, many years. And I have to be honest, I said this someplace else too, I actually like the colors on the 12 and 12 mini better than the colors on the 12 Pro.
Yeah, I agree.
Maybe I'll change my mind.
Again, it's Apple's whole strategy, which is, well, Pro means
premium.
Dark and dull.
Yes, exactly. It's the same problem with the iPad. At least there's a blue, right?
Like,
I like
the
midnight
fun.
Green. I enjoy the midnight green from last year. I've been using that all year. But blue was the most interesting one. But I do think that the 12 mini colors, they're more vibrant. I assume it's a different case, because I think it's stainless steel on the edge.
And it's aluminum. Right, and it's aluminum, yeah.
Yeah, so I was like, the aluminum colors, they look nicer to me, because they've got that... Kind of
little iPod,
look,
iPod Nano hidden in there.
Yeah,
it's sticking so, through.
But I went. Yeah, my
I would
biggest
get a blue
question
phone,
right now.
Regardless, I would get a blue phone if I bought a phone.
Oh yeah,
it would be blue for sure. Yeah,
I did like the I
with
the
no
mint
case
green one
with no case, possibly, right? Because of those sides, it may not be a bar of soap, and we may be able to actually hold it without a case.
I'm very interested to see what's happening. So I don't have a case for this. I noticed this morning that apparently Otterbox is claiming they're like the exclusive MagSafe case, third-party MagSafe case.
Well, they
case.
Were mentioned in the event, so they're the launch partner.
Right. Nobody else has one currently.
Right.
I assume there will be more.
They're making them right now. Right.
Yep. Like, but that's the problem. You got to figure out how the magnets work.
That's true. How do
gotta
they
call
work?
Up the insane clown posse and ask.
That's our. That's. I think we've done that two episodes of this podcast in a row. We've asked how magnets work.
But I will. You know, I ordered a MagSafe charger, mainly out of curiosity, because I have a couple wireless chargers, but I was saying it was funny the day after the iPhone event, I woke up and my iPhone had clearly not been correctly aligned on my wireless charging pad overnight, and it was at 20%.
Yep.
And I was like, damn it, this is why I need MagSafe. Mm-hmm. You know? But yeah, with no case or a very limited number of cases that support it currently, I guess I'll hold off. I mean, yeah. None of the Apple cases.
I mean,
I heard you and Mike.
I'm serious.
About
I don't
the
want a
case.
I always have gone caseless. I would prefer not to. It's only been since the iPhone 6 that I've had to have a case on my phone.
Yeah, I'm with you. I haven't. I used to go caseless, and maybe this year will be the year. But I feel like now I'm so used to it, and so used to the not just the feel and the texture and everything, but the slightly increased size and the fact that I don't tend to drop my phone. Like I tend to have pretty good luck knocking on all the wood that's here. Because I have to turn this one in a week. But I've had pretty good luck with that so far. And I'm worried that like the second I go no case, I will drop my phone.
Yeah, well, you know, only some people can go caseless and fewer people can go caseyless.
Huh? I was on a show with caseyless about that.
It's fascinating. The story that I told on Upgrade, but, you know, the short version of it here is that we spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to get a stick-on wallet for my daughter for her 11, because she was using, like, a hand-me-down phone, and then when she went to college, we got her an 11. And, like, it lasts a quarter, basically. It lasts, like, 10-15 weeks, and then it falls off because the sticking them. And so I saw the leather MagSafe case that Apple is making, wallet, for the back of it, and I'm like, oh, yeah. Like, that's so
that's
smart.
Clever.
Like, that's such clever. A trend that people do that. They just have their cards and a little wallet and maybe some cash stuck to the back of their phone. And this is the first time that Apple has really recognized that and taken it into their own first-party accessories. And I love it. I love it because that shows, again, you know, they're not paying that close attention because they could have done it a long time ago. But I think it's interesting that they're doing it now and that the magnet is the thing that kind of enables it. And I think that's great. I mean, I'm really looking forward to all the weird things that happen with magnets now.
I'm curious to know. I mean, I heard you and Mike talking on Upgrade about like whether or not there's a magnetic pop socket coming, which seems like a no-brainer.
They said they're working on it, but I mean,
how strong are the magnets?
That's
the
trick. They're going to have to figure that out.
Yeah.
But obviously enough that the Apple would put a wallet on it, right? Like if that came off in your pocket when you take your phone out, it wouldn't work. So I think they got to be pretty strong.
I agree. I think, though, that holding the entire phone vis-a-vis, you know, keeping just a leather wallet on the back, I think you could probably
with
get
a little
away
bit
with
of
wallet.
Torque, too. Yeah. I mean, that's the question, right?
Yeah.
But we'll find all that stuff out. But that's exciting because that's actually, again, one of the more interesting things about this is the merchandising aspect. It's the accessory market created by this new thing.
It's also, as we talked about, I think it presages that, you know, the portless iPhone, right? Like, to me, the MagSafe connector points to the fact that maybe not next year, but within the next couple of years, I think they're going to at least try it. And the MagSafe connector does seem to provide a, you know, explanation for it. But it is certainly a challenging thing. We're like already the blowback, you know, on the power plug stuff. I know Samsung tried to make fun of them, and we were all joking about how Samsung will drop that eventually. Because
it's just obvious that next
year
Samsung won't have an adapter
so
in the box. It's just, but in the meantime, make hay while the sun shines, Samsung.
Right. The question is, if you ship a portless iPhone next year or the year after, do you have to include a MagSafe charger in there, basically, or some form of charging?
Yes. So
because otherwise.
Here's my theory, which is I think that all this talk about the portless iPhone is actually talk about Apple wanting to come up with a different way to do attachments, which we've now seen with MagSafe. So I'm unclear. So like The difference is magnets work through material, and the challenge if you do something like the smart connector on the iPad is that you need to either have a conducting pass-through, so the data actually flows through where you've got a little metal something that passes through, or you have to have access to that touch point. But I don't think it's unreasonable at all to imagine that what Apple's going to do is make a phone that has both MagSafe and smart connector in one. Presumably in one, it could be in two different places, but let's just say in one. And in the box will be a MagSafe connector with data, so that if you need to reset your phone, you plug it into a Mac, and if you need to charge it, you plug it into a USB whatever. But it's doing both of those things without actually needing a Lightning connector anymore. And you know, honestly, I think I would prefer that they go to USB-C, because then every phone's got it.
I agree.
But I'm okay with them replacing Lightning with nothing, because I don't want Lightning really around.
Yeah, I think, right. I mean, but that, of course, then it will drive everybody crazy who's like, but you told me I have so many Lightning cables around that I can use.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's already the case, right? Where it's like, well, we put a USB cable in the box. It's like, but most of my little plugs are not USB-C. They're USB-A. Yeah.
It's going to be a tough one.
What a weird company.
I think it's a tough transition.
But too. I think this is what I think the problem with all the supply chain leaks and all the rumors like that, and the rumors about what Apple's doing long term and like the portless, you know, phone. I think the problem with them is you're seeing the end result of the questions that they're asking, but not understand why they're asking the questions. And I think the MagSafe thing shows you what they're really trying to do, which is challenge themselves in terms of like, is there a better way to do this? And like, while like the Qi charging, they're like, is there a better way to do this? And the answer is, well, I mean, yeah, there is a better way where we can use some magnets to align it, and that's better. And with the smart connector, it's a similar thing, right? That Apple wanted to build something on the iPad Pro, and now it's on other iPads too, that let them do keyboard accessories and charging accessories, although that never really went anywhere, but like two-way data and power without having to like plug in a cable. And so they came up with the smart connector to do that, and it's worked pretty well, I have to say. So like, that's their motivation. Their motivation is, why do you have to plug something in? You know, why does it have to be messy like that? Where they get into trouble is if, and this is the argument, the headphone jack argument, right? Which is, where they get into trouble is you've just inconvenienced a lot of people for a benefit that is not perceived as a benefit. And I still hear from people who say, you know, I feel like I've never seen a benefit from not having a headphone jack, and I have to find an adapter every time I want to put my headphones into this iPhone. And I get that. I mean, I deal with that with my iPad Pro.
Fiction. I mean, my wife has lovingly she describes it as the Hydra, which is just a collection of headphones that she shoves in her bag because she's on calls all day. And sometimes she needs to plug into her phone, and sometimes she needs to plug into her laptop. And laptop is a PC. So that is a fun, exciting time of which set of headphones do I have? Which one do I need?
I mean, the truth is that I now mostly use AirPods.
Same.
And so that makes it a lot easier. But if I'm editing or podcasting, AirPods aren't going to cut it. The latency is just not good enough. I'm not going to do it. And so I do have those moments where I have my little headphones in a carrying case with a Lightning adapter and a USB-C adapter. And they go like that everywhere. And they can plug into anything, right? Because they've got the mini jack, and they've got the USB-C, and they've got Lightning. So like, okay, show me your worst, right? Like, I can do this. But I don't know. I mean, I appreciate, this is why Apple is a company worth following, and a company whose products are interesting and liked by so many people like us, is because Apple does ask these questions and push them forward. And the history is mostly on its side, right? History is mostly on the side of the company that is pushing people into uncomfortable places because they have realized it's where it's going anyway, and it's the right side of history to be on. So why don't we get there even if it's uncomfortable? But sometimes they're wrong, and that's frustrating. And being uncomfortable is never fun. But, you know, I think it's all part and parcel with what makes Apple Apple.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's always interesting to figure out what decisions they make and why. I think the HomePod Mini is another great example of that, and I am fascinated by it. I'm on the fence. I may order one just because I'm apparently a HomePod like aficionado. I don't know what the right term is there. I can't stop buying HomePods. And I'm fascinated. The biggest thing that annoys me about the HomePod Mini is that it does show a certain degree of awareness that A, the original HomePod was too expensive.
Yep.
And B, it was kind of big and prioritized the wrong things. They seem to have learned those lessons, which is great. I think $99 is a pretty good price point. If it sounds even half as good as the existing HomePod, it might be twice as expensive as a Dot or a Google Nest Mini or whatever, but it will also sound way better because neither of those are good, are things you want to play music on, really. But what annoys me the most is that in the truly, you know, in hindsight, this should have been obvious Apple fashion and probably was. They didn't basically change like anything else about the HomePod. And there are so many things on the HomePod that could be better. Starting with, as I write in my Macworld Conference next week, the interface is terrible and remains terrible.
I think this is an example of the software being, because they're an integrated hardware and software company, you do have this side effect that happens sometimes where the hardware or software, it's generally with Apple, it's the hardware gets ahead of the software. And so like they build this new HomePod and it's great. And they're like, all right, but somewhere else there's the, you know, HomePod OS team and integrating with iOS, and they, whatever they're doing, we haven't really seen it.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating, right? Like the thing that came up on, I think on Connected this week, maybe it was ATP, I don't know, a podcast mentioned it recently, the idea that AirPods, and I would say HomePod, should have their own apps, like the Apple Watch. Like they should have their own apps, because it's so frustrating to have to try and figure out how to update software or change a setting in these. And it's like, where do we go? Well, on the HomePod, you got to go to the Home app, and then you got to tap and hold until the thing opens, and don't tap that wrong, or music will start to play. And then you got to tap the gear and or swipe. And you know, with AirPods, it's the same thing. Where it's like, do I go to settings? Do I go to Bluetooth?
It's annoying.
Why?
I think that for me, the HomePod thing too is like it comes down to a matter of. It feels like a leftover of we really considered the industrial design, but not exactly how it works. Because in interacting with my HomePod, which as I've said in other places, like it's on my desk, I occasionally reach over to, you know, adjust a light, and my hand, my arm even grazes the top of the HomePod, and all of a sudden, very loud music is playing because I have just hit this touch sensitive surface, which otherwise has no right, doesn't have any controls on it unless it's actively playing things.
Yep.
And even then, like you have to hunt around to find those plus and minus keys, especially if you're at like, you know, desk height. And I'm like, why isn't it just a thing where I tap on it and like draw my finger in a clockwise or counterclockwise circle to adjust the volume? That seems way easier. Like, is there not a real screen?
And you're right. On the hardware, they didn't change any of those things.
Nothing.
Which is fine.
I understand why. And it's one of those things with Apple where you're like, it's always a tightrope walk with them, where it's something like, oh, they did something surprising, and oh, yeah, I should have seen that was obvious, that was exactly how it was going to go, which is, it's just a smaller HomePod. That's all it is.
Yeah, with fewer speakers and fewer features, including, I talk about the software side of it, a new software feature that we didn't know about that seems to have been announced like just in passing in all the press material for this, all the website for Apple has it.
Intercom?
Yeah, well, no, it's that was in the keynote.
Oh, the home theater thing.
Home theater in the traditional, in the big HomePod, which is essentially AirPods Pro style spatial processing, where it's taking a surround sound multi-channel thing and spatially processing it so that you get surround audio from your stereo pair of HomePods in your living room attached to your Apple TV.
Cool. And I heard you and Mike talking about that, and Mike was like, I think this will be great, etc. And I was like, I am with you, except my Apple TV, well, the thing I watch most of my TV through, is not the only thing connected to my TV. And those things are useless when it comes to like my Xbox, which is basically the only other thing I use. Like now I have to have two sets of speakers.
That's why I said that they need to make like a sound bar.
I like that idea a lot.
Because it would be basically the same stuff, except there'd be an input, a pass-through.
The HomePod strikes me as kind of like the AirPods in that if the HomePod Mini shows that you're willing to expand it to a product line,
right,
then, you know, make it a real product line. Don't half-ass it. And I think, you know, maybe that's coming down the pike, as both you and I have talked about on respective podcasts. The existing HomePod is still there, didn't even get a price drop, which I thought was hilarious because it is regularly on deep discount.
You
can get it easily for $200, which is pretty rare for an Apple product, that you can find it pretty consistently on sale for like a third off. So maybe they're burning off inventory, or maybe they're just keeping it there until they have a new model that's ready to go, but it's weird.
Yeah, I did leave the announcement strangely thinking that the HomePod has a future, that the product line, that it's not just, well, we're introducing this and then the old one's going to go away. Given that it has some different things, and they also have software features for the big one, like, I started to think there's going to be another big one, right, at some point, that's got the U1 chip in it and has some other stuff in it, and they make it cheaper so that they can sell it cheaper, and it's not quite as good, but it in some ways, but it's better in other ways. Like, I do feel that way, but the larger point, yes, I see the idea that they've got all the tech to build a soundbar, or really a soundbar that's got an Apple TV embedded in it, right? And it's just like a single box you attach to your TV, and it does everything, right, and has great sound. Like, they could totally do that if they wanted to. And this is my larger question. I know you and I have talked about this before. But what haven't we talked about before, Dan? Apple's home strategy is baffling to me. And yeah, I know that they hired a new guy who's in charge of it now, and he's been in charge of it for a year. So perhaps what's going on is that he's getting, you know, the friendly way to look at this is that you got to give him time to get the house in order, and it's going to take some time. But in the meantime, it's hard not to look at Apple's home strategy and consider it to be in complete disarray, and a place where they can't shoot straight. And for a company like Apple that has the home, I mean, for Pete's sake, they had a whole like dollhouse set in their keynote about that they use for the HomePod, like the home. And they have HomeKit, and like, it all means things and is important to them. And yet, I don't understand their home strategy at all.
And I don't think they do either. I think that's the point.
Unless they're working on it in the background and they've got a plan and it just takes some time to execute. Because, like, for me, things like, you know, the HomePod and Apple TV and a soundbar kind of product, which I think, like, it's just a gimme. It's just a different shape of a HomePod with stereo together. And, like, why would that not be a product? Why would you not do stuff like that? And then the big one that keeps coming up over and over again, which is wireless, right? Like, why would it was so obvious a long time ago, like when Apple dropped the AirPort, that mesh networking with easy setup and security and stuff, all the stuff that Eero is doing is a very much an Apple kind of product. And you could have your HomeKit server in there and all, you know, do all of those things. And you and I think have both written about this in the past, but it's like, they just don't do that. And I get that they don't have infinite bandwidth, but at the same time, actually they have all the money. And
that play is so smart.
And it would be good in Apple stores, because Apple stores are a place where a lot of low technical people come. And like, I have a friend whose Wi-Fi died, and she's like, what router do I get? And you go on the Wirecutter and it's like, here's a UFO with five antennas sticking out of it. And I'm like, you don't want that. And so then I'm like, well, I guess, you know, Eero, which is nice. And I have that, and they sponsored a bunch of podcasts of mine. And it's like, they're good. But like, I keep thinking, if you're Apple, make a good version of that that's got your security and privacy and maybe a VPN and all those things built into it. Put it in the Apple Store. It'll be more expensive than the competition, but you'll sell a million of them and you'll make a lot of money. I don't get it.
The Eero has shown to be a popular seller, despite it is a hefty price tag. But
yes,
it gets the job done. And it's mostly pretty seamless. Like, it has a very Apple-like...
Oh, it's a very Apple-like product, right?
To the point of being like, I get frustrated when it's like, I actually do want to dig around a little bit more and have a little more information, but it's not designed for people like me in that way.
That's my secret about the Eero, is that it's in bridge mode. I turned on off all of its helpful features. I have a router that I administer separately. All it does is the Wi-Fi, and that's fine for me. I don't want it to do anything else. But yeah, it's designed to be like super easy, flip a switch kind of thing. And that's Apple, right? Apple would do it that way too. They'd frustrate you by making it hard for you to.
It used to be the AirPort for a little while. Like, the AirPort was really nice, and then like as everything outpaced it, it never really... Right. They're like, oh, we're going to make it simpler and simpler, which makes sense. Again, it's the product. But I agree with you that I think some sort of home product that takes the lead and be like, look, we've got a soup to nuts solution for you here, right? You need a new Wi-Fi router. Here you go. It's got all the security. It works well. The HomeKit does all the hub stuff. You're all set. And then you can add a HomePod for audio if you want. And you can get all your Apple devices will automatically like join the network and figure out how to get on. And it's just like, that could, yeah, I don't know. I guess they feel like they don't want to be in that market, but I felt like you said, they exited it right at a time where we kind of needed them the most.
Yeah.
And I like my Eero's just fine, but, you know, certainly there is a specter of Amazon hanging over it of in terms of like,
right.
Well, how I'm fine with it at the moment, but is there a point in the future which I will regret having Amazon, you know, be the one who owns my router? And I don't know. Maybe not.
Maybe the new management of the home division at Apple is working on this home, you know, the home alliance where it's the theoretically mm-hmm. it's the disarming of the platform wars, and we're going to get a whole new set of completely compatible things. But this brings up the next question, which is, what's Apple's role in a world where everybody's home stuff is compatible and some of their biggest competition owns a whole bunch and runs a whole bunch of home products? Like for example, HomeKit Secure Video. They announced it a year plus ago, and there's barely any support for it.
I returned my smart cameras that I had set up on my house this week because they ended up being the most frustrating product I've ever worked with.
And so this is my question for this person who's supposedly in charge of Apple's home group, right? Which is, what's your philosophy on having these standards and enabling technologies, and then working with partners who do a bad job? Like, the classic Apple approach here would be that Apple makes a camera. And mm-hmm. Apple makes a doorbell, and Apple makes Apple makes a bunch of stuff where Apple feels like it can make a premium product that shows you the way and says, like, this is the best product that does HomeKit Secure Video, and also lets other people make it because of the interoperability story with all of these different with this new standard that they're working on. Anybody can do it, but Apple's going to do one. It's going to be more expensive, but it's going to be really good, and it's going to have that Apple touch and integrate perfectly with Apple stuff. That, I think, should be their strategy. And I get the counter argument, which is, maybe Apple shouldn't make a camera or a doorbell, right? Like, why should they bother? My response would be two. One would be, all of their competitors own companies that make this stuff, and they do it for the same reason that, too, Apple should do it, which is, what you want to do is not be held captive to the bad products of the only companies in your category who are making this product type. You want to be the flagship yourself, and then, like with your cases, right, for the iPhone, you want to scoop off the top of the market for the people who are not that price sensitive and want the very best stuff. You want to set an example, and then if somebody wants to buy a $10 case on Amazon, you let them. And so I would say, you know, Tim Cook, give me money. We're gonna do this right. We're gonna fill the Apple retail stores next Christmas with home products. And we're going to have we're going to take a corner of the Apple retail store, and we're going to make it into a home.
Yeah.
And it's going to be the smart Apple home, and we're going to own it, and we'll work with everything else, but we're going to own this, and we're going to have the best stuff.
Yeah.
I think they should do that, because the alternative is that they're in this weird case where they're like, you know, work with the standards. Here's HomeKit Secure Video, but none of it is very good. And meanwhile, their competitors
here,
are
get
doing
this thing
it.
From over here. It's very patchwork. I mean, like, I went looking for a replacement for those cameras, and I was like, none of these feels like the right thing for me. And you know, some of it was that, you know, I went to look at the Wirecutter's recommendations of that, and their stuff was all Google Nest stuff. And
right.
I was like, I just really don't want a Google camera. I just don't want one. And, you know, I do wish there were something from Apple in this way. You're right. They have taken this very laissez-faire approach to it of like, go forth and make stuff that works with HomeKit. And, you know, we'll give you the tools. And honestly, the tools are not evenly distributed, in the sense that, like, even when I had the stuff set up for mine that worked with HomeKit Secure Video, didn't support all the features that were in there, even though there were features in the camera, but they weren't supported in HomeKit. And, you know, conflicting ways to set things up versus via HomeKit as opposed to via the company's own app. Like, it was kind of a mess. And troubleshooting it was a pain because it was like, do I have to deal with Apple? Do I have to deal with the manufacturer? I think that if Apple wants to make a play in the smart home space, and making HomeKit suggests they do, then I've said for years that they should at least make a few things to, as you say, like create that template of like, this is how Apple makes a smart switch or smart lights or whatever. And like, make it lead by example.
Yep.
And I think that they've kind of abrogated their responsibility there.
Well, you can see, like, you know, and what we got is, oh, here's a HomePod, and there hasn't been a new Apple TV in a couple of years. And like, I don't know. It feels like this is a category that they should actually be in on and killing it on. And instead, it seems to be just not something they care about at all. And it's weird because it's like, well, the obligatory, like, yeah, we got a home app. But I don't know. It feels like they're missing the boat. And again, I know that they changed leadership last year. So it may, and it takes time. So this may all happen. But I wonder, like, what the heck they're doing. I really wonder about it, because it seems like they've missed a lot of opportunities here. And also, flip side of that, like we've been saying, this is like right in Apple's wheelhouse, I think, which is, oh, there's a lot of stuff out there, but it doesn't work very well and it's crappy and all that. And then that's the moment where Apple rolls in and says, well, we made it easy. And yeah, it's, yeah, you know, it's expensive, but we made it easy and it's good. And you can just buy it when you're buying your new laptop at the Apple store, just throw in a home whatever and thank you very much. Like, this is a huge, it's not just an opportunity for Apple, it's a place that Apple needs. Like, we need Apple there because it's not very good right now. And honestly, the Google Nest stuff and the Amazon's approach to it, like, yeah, some of those products are fine and I have some of those products, but like, it's not great. Like, it's not what Apple could do. And like, Eero is a good example of something that is actually pretty good. But a lot of the stuff that's out there, it's just like, it's okay, it's fine. Yep. It's Google, you know. And sometimes I think, like, Google is a good example of a company that doesn't really know what's good. And they make weird decisions. Did you see that there's a new Nest thermostat that just got announced?
Yeah, I did see that.
Yeah, and it doesn't have the dial that turns it. You just have to like touch on the screen and stuff. And it's like, but that was
like
the
it.
Whole point of the Nest was that it was pretty and it had a ring that you could turn to make it go hotter or colder. And they're like, no, it's just a circle of with plastic that you can stick on a wall. I'm like, okay, you've completely lost the plot of why this product is cool, because you're cheaping out.
I will say whenever it comes to tech products, the mantra I always turn to is, it's the Jeff Goldblum from Jurassic Park, where the engineers, in this case, are so busy thinking about what they can do, they don't stop to think about whether or not they should do it. Oh, we could make just a touchscreen. Everyone loves touchscreens. They use touchscreens all day. Done. You know,
we'll
put in a fancy the system where it can detect whether you're standing in front of it or not, using facial recognition or something like that. And then, guys, you overbuilt it.
Yeah. And that's funny because, like, I have a second generation Nest and, like, it's got an occupancy sensor. It does that fine. It doesn't need more tech than that. And I always preferred the Nest over the Ecobee, which is a more Mac or Apple HomeKit compatible, I should say, product, mostly because the Ecobee is like an app. It's a it's a black plastic with round rects, a black plastic round rect that you stick on your wall, and then it's touch controlled. And I always thought, like, it's a nice product. It's a really good product. But I don't like how it looks, and I don't like how whenever you want to change anything in your house, you got to tap on this little screen and get your fingerprints on it and, you know, use it like an app. Whereas with my Nest, all I ever do to interact with the Nest is turn it or push it, and everything else just happens. It's great. And so Google's just like, man, we're not going to do that. Anyway, my point is, help us, Apple.
Please.
Dan's got a new house.
I do, and I'm going to need a thermostat at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're still selling the older generation Nest. I like it. It's really nice. But, you know, there are the Ecobee stuff is really good because they've got a bunch of smart sensors for it.
Micah was recommending the Ecobee to me because he really likes his.
I don't like the box itself, but, like, it's setup with HomeKit and the fact that it's got remote sensors so that you can set it to be like, to not fire off. Oftentimes thermostats are in weird places where that's not actually where you want to measure the temperature of the house. And so, cause it's like, wow, it's really hot here. Well, yeah, you're right by the outlet. You're not the problem here. It needs to be, how warm is it in the living room? And Ecobee has like sensor you put in the living room and say, use that. And it goes, oh, okay. And then that's it. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, we've solved all of Apple's problems. Send us a check.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll let us know next week.
Be better. Do better at home stuff. Thank you. Mm-hmm. You're welcome. The tragedy is I'm imagining the guy in charge of Apple's home thing listening to this podcast and being like, I'm on it, okay?
I'm trying.
Yeah. But until next week, when we'll be back with who knows what's going to happen. Maybe it'll be better week, Dan. Maybe it'll be better.
Fingers crossed.
Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.